This is Renegade Broadcasting. Everybody, happy Wednesday. Already March 9th. Wow. Already about a third of the way into the month here. Today, it's going to be in the 70s. Good frickin' bye, winter. Good riddance. Don't let the door hit you in the ass on the way out, as they say. Ah, man, I frickin' hate it. But again, this was actually a pretty good winter. I have some friends that were in Florida the past week, and they kept bragging, you know, how nice and warm it is. We're on the beach. It's 80 degrees. I'm like, well, when you guys come back, you're not going to be too happy because, you know, when you come back from a nice warm vacation, you almost want to come back to crappy snowy weather. You know, it makes you feel better that you had, a good break. Now they're coming back to 70 degree weather, not much cooler than what they left from. It's like when I went on a Caribbean cruise a few years ago, back in January of 2012. That was the winter that we had probably the least snow ever on record in my entire life. It snowed once in October. It was really freaky. We usually, for years, haven't been getting any snow in October. Anyway, we had that one small dumpage, and then it melted soon after. And it didn't snow again until March. Just a little dusting. That was it. The whole winter was bone dry. It was great. I mean, we had rain, but no snow. Anyway, I kept thinking it's going to snow any day now, any day. Never came. So, you know, the trip comes now. It was like the middle of January. And so I kept hoping that when we got back, I was going to hear about how horrible the weather was because, of course, we're down in the Caribbean. It's 90 plus degrees out, you know. I'm thinking, this is a great escape, you know, away from winter. No, I get back to discover the ground is still bare. It's still in the, you know, the 50s. It never snowed. Jesus. Of all years, you know, why couldn't I have gone last year when we got inundated with frickin' snow? That's just how Murphy's Law works. But anyway. 70 degrees. I got to get out today and get some hiking or something in, or some biking or whatever. Jesus, great. I love this weather. The bugs aren't out yet. Freaking poison ivy. This is the best time. Best time for outdoor activities. Anyway, picking up where we left off yesterday. Yesterday was one of those instances again where the show cuts off right when I'm about to make a very important point. In fact, it's interesting. I got an email from a listener. He calls in quite a bit. He's like, what do you think about blah, blah, blah? And I wrote back and said, funny you should mention that, because that is exactly the very point that I was just about to make before the show ended. And here it is. We ended off yesterday talking about Jesus's happy ending massage. You know, the woman, some say Mary Magdalene, had broken the alabaster jar of expensive perfume and was anointing his body, rubbing him down. And the disciples, specifically Judas, were told in some gospel, one of the gospels, another one says that it was, Mark says that it was several of the apostles, whatever. We're told that complaints were made. Hey, you know, this woman's wasting a year's wages worth of perfume that could have been used to sell and give to the poor, you know. And Jesus's response was, you know, screw the poor. You'll always have the poor with you. Leave her alone. She's doing well. Oh, yeah, because he was getting off on it, right? That act, that statement of Christ was the very thing that caused Judas to turn against him and, quote, betray him. So, what this listener had asked yesterday, you know, what do you think of this? That Judas was the good guy here. He recognized now that Jesus had deceived him and everybody else, you know, that he was disillusioned by this scoundrel, and that his claim to be a great religious leader was just a cloak for his own selfish political aims. That is what inspired Judas to turn him in to the authorities. Can you blame him? Judas now realized, hey, wait a minute, this guy doesn't give a damn about the poor. He's having this woman waste a year's wages just so he can get his frickin' rocks off. All his talk about religion was a sham. Judas realized Jesus was a fraud. God damn it, he sucked me in. Just like all these other phony messianic claimants. Jesus was telling us, don't listen to them, listen to me. Remember, we read several verses like that yesterday. I am the way. Nobody comes unto the Father but by me. In other words, all these other guys, he even said it, right? All the other all the other leaders are thieves that have come but to steal. But I'm not that way. What does that sound like today, ladies and gentlemen? In a modern context, we see all the churches do that, don't we? Over 3,000 Christian denominations in this country, and pretty much all of them make the claim that they're the true church. Don't listen to these other ones. They're all false. The Adventist Church is really big on that one. Quite a few of them have gotten away from that now because of, you know, ecumenism. We're all one in Jesus. Yeah, whatever. But a great many of them, especially Adventism, they're particularly obnoxious with this. They claim that they're the true church and all the others are false. They call them Babylon, fallen Babylon. That's what Jesus was doing. He was calling all the other sects, all the other religious leaders, all the other messianic claimants, phonies. I'm the true one. He had, you know, all the disciples sucked in. He had Judas sucked in with that rhetoric, right? Judas believed that he belonged to the true church and that his leader was the true Messiah. But now he hears Jesus make a statement like that. Basically, screw the poor. Leave her alone. She's doing good. I'm getting off on this, guys. This is great. And so he realizes, wow, frig this guy. I'm done. This guy's a fraud. So he goes and turns him in. Can you blame him? He realizes he's a fake. He's not, you know, this great leader who's going to lead us to glory. And that's what all these messianic claimants professed, right? They were bringing in the kingdom. The kingdom is at hand, he told them. Don't forget, he said, many of you standing here will not taste death until you see the Son of Man coming in his glory. They interpreted that. Judas interpreted that, understandably so, that Jesus' great coming kingdom and thus the end of Roman rule was going to take place in their lifetime. Now he sees that Jesus is saying, hey guys, yeah, pretty soon I'm going to go to Jerusalem and I'm going to be crucified. It's like, hey, whoa, wait a minute. What are you talking about? Which, if you ask me, guys, I think the whole thing was goddamn staged. He wasn't crucified. But nevertheless, the real clincher was this incident, the frickin' happy ending rubdown. Now he realizes this guy is a scam artist. He doesn't care about the poor. He's only in this for his own self, you know, exaltation. And that's what made him turn him in. So just like in the debate between Jesus and the Pharisees, lo and behold, it turns out the Pharisees were the good guys, not Jesus. He wasn't the good guy in that. Now we see, sure enough, between Jesus and Judas, will the real bad guy please stand up? Guys, like so many other things in life, the reality is far different from the one that we've been sold. The truth is entirely the opposite of what we've been told, and so it is here. Judas wasn't the bad guy. Oh, but he betrayed Jesus. Jesus was the betrayer, ladies and gentlemen. He was the rabble-rouser. He was the one. He and all the other scum that were in league with him, they were the ones that brought the Roman destruction of Jerusalem upon themselves. Judas wasn't the bad guy. He turned this insurgent in, this insurrectionist. He turned him in. He realized now the dead-end road that this monstrosity was leading them down. Judas was the good guy. Well, what do you know about that? In the very next two verses, after the passage we ended off reading yesterday, Mark 14, 3 to 9 tells the story of the frickin' happy ending rubdown, right? The next two verses we read, then Judas Iscariot, one of the 12, went to the chief priests to betray Jesus to them. Notice that, they're trying to make Jesus the hero here. So they put the word betray in here, right? He betrayed our great Jesus. Because they want you to think that he's the hero in this story. But once you realize what a monstrosity he was, and that they're trying to make a martyr out of him, Judas wasn't the bad guy. Guys, once again, Judas is the only disciple that did not come from frickin' Galilee, which is where all the terrorists were recruited from. No wonder he was different from all the rest. Oh yeah, his name is Iscariot, means Sicarii. It comes from, So clearly he was, initially anyway, he was a rebel, but at this point he realized, nah, there's something wrong with this whole movement here. I've been duped. They're just using religion as a cloak. He gave the whole thing up. And as far as the story of him, killing himself, oh, the BS meter is going off the charts on that one. As I pointed out before, guys, there's two different stories, like so many other things in that damn book, contradiction after contradiction. Excuse me. There's two different stories about his alleged assassination, his alleged suicide. One says that he hung himself. The other story says he simply fell to the ground and his guts burst open, whatever the hell that means. Oh, yeah, that happens all the time. People just drop to the ground and their stomach bursts open. What's that supposed to mean? Some divine intervention? The great Yahya, the psychopathic bastard Yahya, miraculously slaughtered him in that fashion? Why didn't the great Yah slaughter him ahead of time so he wouldn't betray his great Jesus Junior? Oh, I know. Because Yah wanted Jesus to die. Remember those verses? It pleased the Lord to bruise him. Strike the shepherd, said Yahya. He wanted his son to suffer and die because he got off on that, apparently. Just like he gets off on everybody else suffering and dying. So he didn't want to intervene, even though Jesus, poured his heart out in the Garden of Gethsemane. Oh, Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. I came here for this purpose, but I'd rather not do this. What a frickin', how the hell can Christians buy this crap? Why would he pray that something be lifted from him if his whole mission was to come here for that purpose? Does that make any goddamn sense, Christian numbskulls? Oh, he was showing his human side. Get the hell out of here. Again, that's their little trump card BS excuse they pull out of their sleeve to explain away major problems that should tip them off that something's wrong here. Sorry, that explanation doesn't cut it. Showing his human side, he stated over and over, for this purpose came I into the world. And now he's praying that he not have to go through it? What the hell, man? God damn it. So ridiculous. It makes me think. I don't know if I want to go off on this tangent, but I'm a big fan of the old David Carradine Kung Fu series. That's my favorite all-time TV series. I got all the shows on DVD. Just loved it as a kid. Still love it. Except for one episode in the final series, the final season. It was a two-part episode. I think it was the only time they had a sequel, a two-part show. It's the worst one ever. I don't know where the hell that came from. I forget now even the storyline of it. It's been so long since I watched it. I got the thing years ago. I'll have to revisit it sometime. But I couldn't. It was horrible. I don't remember seeing that as a kid. I thought I had seen them all, but when I got the series on DVD, I don't remember seeing that one. It was just the worst. I forget the storyline, but anyway, in that show, it depicted Carradine, or Grasshopper, the character there. It depicted him as using his kung fu powers, like to impress people. He was kind of showing off, and I'm like, wow, this is so out of character for what he was supposed to be. He's supposed to be this humble guy who only used his kung fu abilities when necessary, to help people. He wasn't one to boast, to brag about himself. But in this show, it was the only time he ever did it. It was so out of character. Anyway, I'm bringing that up to make the point. That's what you have with Jesus praying in Gethsemane. If it be possible, let this cup pass from me. It's so out of character for what you would expect to come from somebody who's supposed to be the divine son of God, who knew why he came here. Oh, there's other things like that too. When he's on the cross, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Didn't he know that his dada was going to have to forsake him because he was supposedly bearing the sins of the world? I mean, it just doesn't make sense. There's quite a few statements like that, of course. Not to mention, go and bring those who won't worship me, accept me as king and bow before me, bring them before me and kill them in front of me. Oh, but is that really out of character once you know what kind of character he really was? No, it's not out of character at all. But nevertheless, look at the schizophrenic message in this schizophrenic book. Schizophrenic God and a schizophrenic Yahweh Jr. Schizophrenic Messiah. But Bible dupes have no problem with that. They just sweep it under that rug with that other huge pile they got under there. Sweep, 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 sweep. I swept things like that under the rug years ago as a Bible believer. I just ignored them because I thought, oh, I'm just not understanding it properly in my feeble mind. I'm not able to comprehend these deep truths right now. Someday I'll understand them. That's what I thought. Well, I was right. In ways I never imagined, but I was right. Someday I will understand them. Oh, I understand them now. I understand them now. I thought back then, though, that I would come to understand them as a Bible believer, and it would strengthen my faith. Well, again, I understand them now, and it did strengthen my faith. Strengthen my faith in the fact that this book is a raging pile of steaming horse crap. Anyway, so in the next two verses, coming back to our notes here, after the happy ending rubdown, we read, then Judas Iscariot, one of the 12, went to the chief priests to betray Jesus to them. They were delighted to hear this and promised to give him money. So he watched for an opportunity to hand him over. He didn't do it for the money, guys. In fact, later we're told that he went back and threw the money into the temple. And why? Not because he regretted turning him in. No, he probably realized my ass is grass. He probably got death threats. You're done. We're going to get you. You just wait. And so the story we're told that he hung himself, or the other one that he fell to the ground and his guts burst open. Guys, they murdered him. God damn it. It's obvious. Oh, but they wouldn't do that. Oh, really? How about the story of Ananias and Sapphira that Peter cursed and they dropped dead right on the spot? Peter probably poisoned them ahead of time. Hey, here, try this. A fresh loaf of pita bread I just made. Check it out. Really good. And then he cursed them in the name of the Lord, it says, and they dropped dead because it was discovered that they had some money. Or, as I pointed out on a previous show, maybe that whole thing was simply staged and they pretended to die. And so Peter could send the message, don't hold any money back from the Lord or you'll be cursed dead too. In either case, it doesn't matter whether he really, poisoned them or something, or whether they fake their death just to make that illustration to give you money or else. It doesn't matter. Look at the psychopathic mentality of that bastard. Peter cursed them so that they died. Oh, that's real nice. What a godly man. Doesn't he sound like so many Christians out there today? So filled with love. They love you so much they want to kill you. They do, ladies and gentlemen. Most Christians are hateful little bastards and bitches. They are. They're wretched, hateful bastards and bitches. Phony, hypocritical, holier than thou, judgmental, gossiping bastards and bitches. They're evil. Absolutely evil. They like to demonize everybody else and call them evil. Once again, just to make themselves look good and feel good. They look and feel good when they can condemn others. Goddamn phonies. Once again, my apologies to the few out there that are sincere. And I do mean few. But the overwhelming majority of them are just as fake as their leader was. Anyway. I don't even know if I mentioned the fact that Judas was murdered in these notes. I'll have to go back in and add that later because that seems pretty obvious. Again, the very fact that we got two different accounts of his death. Come on, guys. They freaking killed him. Just as they have done all through the centuries. Christians have always killed, be they Catholic or Protestant, it doesn't matter. They've always killed those who opposed them. Always. And yet they'll point, a condemning finger at Muslims for doing that. Clean up your own goddamn closet first before you go talking about other people's religion. You have nothing up on them. As a matter of fact, you do have something up on them. You have a much bigger murder rap sheet than they do. Oh, hell yeah. Hell yeah. Your religion has murdered far more people than the Mohammedans. You got nothing on them. Nothing. Just like they like to, condemn the Quran, all its contradictions, blah, blah, blah. Holy Christ, man. Your goddamn holy book has way more contradictions than theirs. One of the reasons being, perhaps, that your book is much thicker than theirs. But it doesn't matter. Got no grounds for condemning them, their holy book, or their God. Look at your God. Your holy book portrays your God as a far worse demon than the Quran portrays Allah. Oh, hell yeah. So obviously, guys, what went on here is that Judas finally figured out that Christ was up to something of which he wanted no part. And that he wasn't the great sinless leader that he professed to be. This is why he, quote, betrayed Christ. No doubt, Judas, again, you know, was a zealot himself, at least initially, anyway. He wanted to overthrow the hierarchy in Jerusalem and ultimately Rome. But perhaps he was disillusioned to discover that his great leader was not what he thought he was, or that he caught wind, that there was a change in plans, that the overthrow would not happen in the time frame or manner that he desired, whatever. So he said, screw this, I'm turning this guy in. He's a fraud. And then later, he gets assassinated. Probably received some death threats from the holy apostles. Oh my God. Oh, the reality is so different from what we've been told, with this, as with so many other things. Anyway, I see Skype is acting weird again, but I think we're good. So bizarre. Gotta love technology, man. With every update, every upgrade, goddamn thing runs worse and worse. That's the case across the board. I see it with my frickin' phone, with my Kindle, computers. With every update, the thing runs crappier, slower, more problems. Oh, yeah. Oh, that's all by accident, of course. One of the frickin' reasons, guys, aside from installing spyware in your goddamn device, with every new upgrade, what are they doing? They're slowing it down, creating the need for you to go out and buy a new one. Anyway, back to our notes here. The very name Jesus was actually not the real name of this zealot. The New Testament was written in Greek, and thus Jesus is a Greek name, not a Hebrew name. Sure, there was a lot of Hellenism that slipped into Judea at this time. But, into the Holy Land across the board. But doesn't matter, guys, especially being of, the lineage of David, he would not have been given a Greek name. In Hebrew, his real name was Yeshua or Joshua in English. Joshua, of course, is the one who led the people of Israel, we're told, from the wilderness into their promised land, conquering every nation that stood in their way through endless bloody battles. That's what Jesus was all for, wasn't he? He was a militant. But he didn't come outright and say that, at least not very often. He dropped little hints of it here and there. Like I said, he stated, I came not to bring peace but a sword. He did drop little subtle indications here and there, but for the most part, he didn't speak openly like that because, again, he knew it would get him arrested. So many other messianic claimants were found out to have been militants and were executed. So he didn't want that to happen to him, at least, not right away. It turns out this was the type of Messiah the Jews were expecting when Jesus started his ministry. They wanted somebody who was a militant. That's what Jesus was, but in a subtle way, not so openly. All right, guys, short break, right back.
There's a resurgence of anti-Semitism because at this point in time, Europe has not yet learned how to be multicultural. And I think we're going to be part of the throes of that of that transformation, which must take place. Europe is not going to be the monolithic societies that they once were in the last century. Jews are going to be at the center of that. It's a huge transformation for Europe to make. They are now going into a multicultural mode, and Jews will be resented because of our leading role. But without that leading role and without that transformation, Europe will not survive.
Hey guys, welcome back. So, as I was about to say before the break, it appears from his very name that the great Jesus, i.e. Joshua, was intended from his birth to fulfill this same role, the Joshua role of leading his people into glory through battle. That was the original plan. That's what he was named Joshua for. You don't name Joshua, especially at that time, with all the uprisings going on, for no reason. He was of the bloodline, and it was hoped that he was going to be the great promised one, you know, would lead his people into glory. He used religion, like several other messianic claimants of the day, to lure people in. Judas eventually saw through it, though. That's why he turned him in. This screwed up their plans, but to the very end, it was hoped things would still work out. As we'll see, there's some very clear indications in the Gospels that up to the very end, it was still hoped that things would work out the way it was planned, that this military uprising would take place. When Jesus marched in on the donkey into Jerusalem, later when, you know, Jesus told the disciples, go get a sword. If you don't have one, sell your cloak and buy one. It was still hope that there would be this uprising, that the masses would up, you know. It didn't happen. Jesus wasn't able to reform the Pharisees like he had planned and get them on his side, so they had to change their plan. Anyway, we got a caller. Welcome to the show. I think we do. Or are you just calling to listen?
No, I was calling to ask you to...
Oh, hey, how's it going, man?
How you doing, Charlie? Some really great rants. I believe Friday last week I caught up to your shows, and it was you were really good at it. You really did a good job.
What was I talking about Friday? I don't remember.
It was just an overall religious rant.
Oh, okay.
Religious rants are always the best. You know, you're the only one that does it. So
yeah, it's sad.
It's refreshing.
Very sad.
Yeah, you're the only one that does it. I wanted to point a couple things out. I had sent you the link to that young boy talking about...
Oh, isn't that disgusting? I had several people actually send me that same link. My God.
Yeah. It's made it to YouTube. I don't know how long it'll be up because, you know...
For those who don't know, it's this young British kid that was part of some... it was a Christian church, right?
Yeah, of course. Well, all of anything, a lot of times people incorrectly call satanic cults, they call it wrong because they're literally, you know, you have to consider what they really are. They're an offshoot of Christianity.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they pray and praise supposedly the devil or Satan. And, you know, you can't get around that fact that this is a byproduct of Christianity or any religion for that matter.
Sure. They're all the same, ultimately. Anyway, it's this young kid, folks, who describes how, you know, being involved with this, quote, this church. There was, you know, sacrifices. It's very, very upsetting. You know, if you get a weak stomach, you don't want to listen to this. It's so disgusting. But he describes in horrific detail killing of babies and you know, sexual acts with babies. Oh, my God, man. Wow, what a sick, sick world.
He was so, you know, you could tell that it was a matter of fact thing that this boy was saying, because, you know, he didn't hesitate when he was talking about it. He was expressing what he knew in his own terms, because he's a young boy. But the point is, you could see how at a young age we can be brought up in any kind of environment, and we just accept whatever they tell us without any question. Just like we have wars, you know, we have wars because people tell us somebody attacked us. You know, we now know that these are always lies. It's just the ruling class wanting to steal more and own more of the world for the, you know, for their own benefit.
Right.
But the young people, young children like this, that movie that recently came out, I believe it was Spotlight, that won the Academy Award. It really great movie, but it shows just how young people are abused, and the multitude just stands, you know, stands by, and most don't say anything.
Right.
Because they're doing their best to protect a religion that they believe is true.
Yeah.
And so we always have to blame ourselves for what's going on, because although it's not our fault, critical thinking and reason, we were never really taught that, how that works, where we can have an open discussion about something and not a debate where everybody just starts calling one another names. But it's starting, that video is starting to, you know, catch on the internet.
Oh, I hope it goes viral. Yeah.
Yeah, now it's on the, you know, but the other thing, you could look at it everywhere around the world. Everywhere we sent missionaries, or any religions have been sending missionaries, you have this mindlessness that's so part of the that all the cultures, and it's ridiculous. I don't know if you've seen the Africans burning other Africans, you know, burning them because they weren't Christians.
Right. Oh yeah.
But that's out there where you could see all this stuff. You know, just look at what that religion called is Judaism, what it's doing to other people simply because they want to steal land and they think they're better than everybody else.
Right.
And so it's just so horrible to watch all this and know that so many people just turn their head again. You know, they turn their head away. They don't want to know it. They don't want to see it.
Christians love that quote, you know, by their fruits you will know them. Well, look at the fruits of your own damn religion. Look what it's done all through the centuries, over and over and over and over and over. Be it Catholic, Protestant, it doesn't matter. It's all the same. And when it comes to this stuff, there's been slaughterings left and right, back and forth. Well, by your fruit you'll know them.
Yeah, well, I'm sure you've seen some of the things where they're, some of the Jewish people, they cut the throats of chickens and they spin them around over their heads.
Yeah.
These are absurd. All these things are absurd. Even some of the Christianity or Christians, where you have people that are reenacting eating the flesh of Jesus Christ. I just recently, about a year ago, I was forced to attend a baptism of one of my grandchildren, and both my sister and the female reverend in charge of this church told me that it was perfectly all right if I go take the bread of Jesus, and I said that I had given up any type of practice, even if it, you know, it's just, if it isn't real, anything to do with any kind of cannibalism, because I find it absurd. And so I said that, and neither one of them even responded to me.
Yeah.
Because they're not even aware of that. Look what you're doing, you know. So that's what I mean, is this young boy is talking about something, and now if he stays on the influence of this, you know, how he, you know, you could see how, like, what's not even his fault.
Right.
Who's the person that had to introduce them to this? You know, you have to feel so sad for him.
Right.
Like, he said it like it was normal. Yeah, this is what we do. We eat the flesh. You know, we cook it
drink
all up
the blood.
And we eat it.
Yeah.
we drink the blood, we clean the skulls of the babies, you know, and you're like, look, this is your religion, people. You know, don't call it something other than what it is. This is Christianity.
Most people don't realize that the great Yah commanded human sacrifice on numerous occasions. It's all over the place in the book.
Yeah, well, look, like you say, look, I sent the one clip to you. We're supposed to teach our children a certain way according to the Bible, and yet, you know, Yahweh killed how many of his own children?
Right, yeah,
And it's insane. None of this makes any sense after all.
Yeah.
You know, you have to have something better than this. This can't be like this.
You can't stand for human decency, truth, justice, all that, and embrace this friggin' book of detestable filth. You can't do it.
And once you realize how so much of it is simply based on or tradition that we had no idea anything about, like the clip I sent you or the article about the fact that when you really can't kosher meat because the meat itself doesn't have any blood in it, you know, they don't even have that right. None of this stuff is actually
right.
Correct.
Lie after endless, you know, lie.
Yeah, it's, you know, so you're making these animals drown in their blood, and it, even if you don't do it, there's no blood in the meat. It doesn't matter. But
yeah.
They can't even see that this is not, you know, they don't know this. You know, how can this be true? Is if you examine the meat and there's no blood in it, this is just simply the color of the meat. But they can't see this. There's no. It's like a mind. Religion is like a mind stopping thing. You know,
right.
This is the way it is right here. It can't be anything else. This is crazy. It is as it is. You know, even even some of this other stuff that they say, like how you're not supposed to eat pork. Well, if you look back to the traditions of the Egyptians, the only people that were allowed to eat pork were the extreme royalty.
Mm.
And if you've ever had a pig roast, you realize why this is the case. You know, it's an absolutely delicious meal. Well, why would you let the paupers have this?
Right.
You know, the common people. So, of course, they would say, oh, you can't eat pork. Bring it to us. We'll eat it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we'll roast it and eat it and enjoy it. But, you know, this is not something you're supposed to do. Stay away from that, you know.
Right.
And it's always because of some sort of self gain that these religions come about by. You know, laziness, really. That's really what it comes down to. I mean, how many times you said it, well, when you become a reverend, hey, it's a pretty good gig. You know, I'm not going to be doing that much work.
And that's why most go into it. Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's what I mean. So it's a method of control, you know, and to get people to do something for you without them even realizing that they're not. If you look at everyday jobs, you see that, where these people do this thing, and they don't even consider the fact that, do we really need this job that I do? I mean, financing, is that really necessary? Do we need to do it? I mean, a house, you know, look at how much houses are, even though, you know, the economy, the capitalism itself is depressing everything. You really need to spend all these zeros and ones that you have to work for?
Yeah.
When a house maybe is only worth $35,000 once it's built?
Yeah.
You know, it's
perpetual
insane,
enslavement. That's what it is. They're getting cars
exactly.
To that point now. They pretty much are at that point. Most people don't have $25,000 to $30,000 to shell out, which is what a house used to cost just a few decades ago. Now you're paying that for a freaking car that's going to be ready for the scrap heap in 4 or 5 years by the time it's paid off. It's insanity.
And not only that, look.
There's no need of it.
Not only that. Realize that any advantage that's been done because of technology, like most of these car plants, are almost humanless.
Yeah.
So every aspect of the development of the car
is
so much less than it was 30 years ago.
Artificially
when they started
devices,
doing robots,
they should be cheaper. They should be cheaper than they
have. Yeah, but see, people don't realize that under this system that we have, it's not about what's good for us. It's about whatever the market will bear.
Yeah.
So as more and more, less and less people can buy homes because they have to rent.
Remember back in in the 70s, calculators first came out, they were $100. And I was thinking, wow, that's ridiculous. That's so much money. Now they give them away. I mean, you can buy them for freaking a dollar at the dollar store, right? There's no need of it. Your cell phones, they could sell those freaking things for $5, $10, no problem. They sell them for hundreds of dollars. There's no need of it. Computers have now substantially been reduced, haven't they? Why? Because most everybody has them now. But initially, you would spend, you know, $3,000-$4,000 for computers now that you're paying $300 or $400 for.
Yeah, exactly. And we realized that the calculator in the 1970s was basically the computer on board the supposed, you know, a space shuttle. Satellites and all.
Yeah.
They really didn't have it. You know, there was really such a limitation.
Right.
Back then. But the amazing thing that all this stuff is happening now, you know, and you know, do you see any real progress being talked about by any of the candidates that we have?
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
Nobody's saying anything like, well, yeah, we need to go beyond the system we have. You know, only a couple of countries now are realizing that you have to have some sort of guaranteed income so people don't live on the streets. You know, you know, people talk about Bernie Sanders or Trump. I haven't heard either one of these people who are supposed to represent us say anything about the tent cities all over the country.
And you won't either. You know, they're all
people living under bridges. You know, and you say this to people, and these people, most people, because they listen to the news, they don't even know this exists around them. They don't even know about this.
Right.
It's totally amazing, and it all comes back to religion, being controlled completely from cradle to grave by this system and everything that goes along with it.
Yeah.
You know, and it's so sad. I mean, just like I said, just think about what the reverend or priest is saying. Just think about that.
Yeah.
How selective they are in the Bible.
Right.
You know, I remember when I was a child, every single year I was like, didn't they talk about this last year? Didn't they talk, you know?
I like that thing that you sent me about, you know, how come faith healers never go to hospitals to heal people? They only expect handicapped people or sick people or whatever to come to them when they're having their little tent meetings or whatever, you know.
Yeah, and even then, that's all scripted. I mean, interview the people, they find out what it is. But like I said, the most obvious things that you can say to a person, and they're so childish, you know, they're so childish that they don't even think about these things. And so
there shouldn't be any more handicapped or sick people in the world with all these so-called faith healers out there, right? They should have alleviated human suffering by now.
Yeah.
Well, and everybody would want to convert to, you know, the Jesus cult because so many people are getting healed just for that reason.
Yeah, why hasn't he healed any amputees?
Yeah.
You know, surely these people could work some sort of miracle, and you know, grow back the legs of some people or grow people's fingers back, but you never see anything like this, and Christians seem to be okay with it. It's all right, I guess.
Yeah.
As long as we're able to go back to church and just, you know, let our minds fester, not think about anything, just, you know, no worries in the world. You know, that's I guess that's the biggest problem, is that we just get used to everything, and we like, well, that's just the way it is. You know, we can't change anything, I guess. I guess that's the mindset of people.
Yeah.
It's insane the more
it's
you
the
think
easy
about
way
it.
Out.
So my point, you know, I just wanted to check in with you and let you know what's going on, and tell you to keep up these rants, because damn, just remember it. You know, after, you know, it's sort of like 9/11 religion. Once you realize that the planes were going faster than they possibly could,
yeah,
because the, you know, they're limited, and these planes are flying into the towers at 550 miles an hour. There's nowhere else to, you really don't have to go further than that. These planes can't travel this fast.
Right.
So once you look at any part of the Bible and you see just the several contradictions, you're like, well, why are we even talking about this nonsense?
Exactly. Yep.
You know, I mean, really, we're koshering animals because to get rid of blood that we're not getting rid of because it's not in the meat.
Yeah.
I mean, so what else is nonsensical about this? Everything.
Everything.
Nothing makes any sense.
Nope.
So keep the rants going, Charlie.
All right, Ben, thanks for the call, buddy.
All right, bye.
Yeah, take care. Yeah, guys, that's the message of this show, ever has been. Everything in this world is a lie. We are inundated with lies. Anyway, and people don't want to hear it. That's the problem. That's the freaking problem. You think they'd be glad to discover that, wow, yeah, I mean, some are, but most people, they don't want to hear the truth. They really don't. The you know, they want instant gratification, right? Well, lies bring that, don't they? Lies bring instant gratification because lies are presented as tasting so sweet. It doesn't matter that later when that lie is swallowed and it settles in their stomach and it's going to, you know, give them a stomach ache and make them sick and ultimately kill them. They don't care about that. They're just looking at the here and now. I want that nice, sweet taste in my mouth. When the truth comes along, it's so bitter. It doesn't matter that later when it settles in their stomach, it's going to ease their pains and sufferings and, you know, bring life to them. Nope. It's that initial bitter taste. They don't want any part of it. Unbelievable. They love the lies. They gobble them up. And the minute the truth comes along, they not only want to take the hatchet to the truth, but to those who tell it. Anyway, picking up with our notes here, let's look at the failed insurrection. We know of several instances where the Jews carried out capital punishment via stoning. For example, we have the story of how Jesus saw a woman about to be stoned for adultery by the Jewish priests. And you know, that's when he said, he that is without sin cast the first stone, you know, whatever. A story, by the way, that's only found in the book of John, not in the other gospels. Nevertheless, that does give us a clue as to how things worked back then. When you were convicted of a religious crime, that's how you died. Rome didn't step in. They left it up to the local Jewish leaders to carry that out. That wasn't a crime against the Roman state. It was a crime against the Jewish religion. So you handle that. And so that's what they would do. They would stone her, going back to, you know, Old Testament times. Stone him or her, you know, whatever. There was also the instance of Stephen, who was martyred by the Jews for his faith in the great Jesus by stoning not long after Jesus' death. That's another example. So why wasn't Jesus killed this same way by the Jews? Why wasn't he instead stoned to death and instead of being crucified, right? Why was he killed by the Romans? Could it be that they knew he was planning an insurrection as a zealot, that he was guilty of treason? That is exactly the reason. Just look at the manner in which he rode into Jerusalem, riding on an ass's colt as a Jewish king coming to claim his throne. He did this to make it appear as though he was fulfilling a prophecy in Zechariah. In fact, let's take a look at that prophecy. Zechariah 9:9 states, "Rejoice greatly, daughter of Zion. Cry out, daughter of Jerusalem. Behold, your king is coming to you. Righteous and victorious is he, humble and riding upon an ass, upon a colt, the son of a donkey." This passage is saying that when your king comes, your promised Messiah, he will be riding on an ass. The ass will be riding on an ass. Jesus went out of his way to get a hold of a donkey, to make sure that when he rode into Jerusalem, he would be doing it on a donkey, so that they would look back and remember this prophecy and think, ah, this is our king, which is why they waved palm branches in the street and hailed him as such. Jesus was hoping, as were his followers, that this was it. The people were going to rise up now overthrow the scribes and Pharisees who had been rejecting him and calling for his death. You know, they wanted him dead, right? They wanted him dead because they knew what he was. He was a fake, you know, a rebel rouser, right? It was hope that this was going to bring it about, you know, that the people were going to stand up now and overthrow the, you know, we're not going to listen to them anymore. This is our promised one. It didn't happen, though. Even though they waved palm branches, you know, they greeted him as king, right? They were hoping that he was going to do something. Jesus was hoping that they were going to do something. Neither happened. Jesus didn't do anything. The people didn't do anything. The whole thing went belly up. That's why they had to plan a different strategy. We got to infiltrate Rome. We're going to let Rome come in. We're going to help Rome come in and overthrow the Pharisees. Then later we'll infiltrate Rome. It's not going to happen in the timing and in the fashion that we wanted. That's all this was, guys. The plan failed. At first, it looked like it was going to succeed. Wow, it's working. Yeah, they recognize that I'm trying to fulfill that Zechariah prophecy. They're thinking, I'm the promised one. I'm the king. They're waving palm branches. Soon, hopefully now, there'll be an uprising. It didn't happen. 5 days later, those same people that were waving palm branches obviously recognized he was a fraud. And now they're siding with the scribes and Pharisees and shouting, crucify him. He didn't, you know, call for an uprising, and he didn't lead out in this. Jesus didn't want to have to lead out in it. He was hoping they were going to do it. And by the way, by him riding, you know, on the donkey, notice what a wimpy tactic that was. He didn't come out and say, here I am, I'm the king, because the Romans would have sacked him right there. He rode in on a donkey. The Romans didn't know what the hell was going on. He knew that, you know, his fellow tribe members would know. They knew the prophecy in Zechariah 9:9. They knew what that meant. He wasn't worried about the Romans sacking him because, again, they didn't know what that meant. Oh, my God, man, you got to love it. This whole freaking story, oh, it crumbles to dust right before your eyes. Once you do what Christians always tell you to do but never do, once you take the historical context into consideration, that's it. It falls apart. The whole damn story is seen for what it is. All right, guys, short break. Pick up there. We'll be back.
Now, let's hear from a Jewish academic.
My concern is doing away with whiteness. Whiteness is a form of racial oppression, sure. The suggestion is that it is somehow possible to separate whiteness from oppression, and it is not. There can be no white race without the phenomenon of white supremacists. In the same way, if you abolish racial oppression, you do away with whiteness. Treason to whiteness is loyalty to humanity.
Your views are fairly well received in academia.
Yes, they're legitimate. Not to say that everyone agrees, but sure. And the task is to bring this minority together in such a way that it makes it impossible for the legacy of whiteness to continue to reproduce it.
This is Renegade Broadcasting.
Alright guys, already into the second half of the show here. So, here he was, riding on the donkey, proclaiming himself as king, right? And could you think of a more fitting beast for a Jewish king to sit on than a jackass? But anyway, another provocation shortly before this time was when he went into the temple and drove out the money changers, right? Threw his little temper tantrum. That was an obnoxious, in-your-face challenge to priestly authority. The scribes and Pharisees knew what he was doing. He was extremely antagonistic. He was hoping for an uprising. He didn't want to come out and say, let's rise up now, get your swords. No, he was hoping that everything would fall into place on its own without him having to come out and say anything directly. It didn't work. Because all the while, the people were hoping that he was going to initiate it. It didn't happen the way it was planned. Anyway, Jesus also said, destroy this temple and I will raise it up in 3 days. Now, you know, he made a disclaimer statement that, it was his body that he was talking about. But it doesn't matter, guys. The Romans would have seen that as a reference to the physical temple, and I'm sure he intended it to have that double meaning. He was taunting the Jewish leaders and the Romans. Go ahead, destroy this temple. You can bet rumors, not just rumors, but actual threats were made by the Romans that if you don't stop with these uprisings, we're going to come in and destroy your temple. How does that grab you? Knock it off. They were getting fed up, getting pissed off. Can you blame them? And so Jesus, to make that claim, he's taunting the Romans. Go ahead, destroy this body, this temple, and in 3 days I'll raise it up again. He used the word temple. He was taunting them. I'll have so many people behind me, backing me up. You can destroy this temple, and yet we're going to take control of everything, kick you out, and we're going to rebuild this temple, and we're going to become a formidable force that will eventually take you down. You know, that was the message. Because I'm the king. Clearly a warrant went out for his arrest at this time. In fact, in the early 20th century, an old Slavonic text was discovered that recorded a description Josephus gave of a wanted man that the Jewish leadership was hunting for at the time of Christ. It read as follows. Wanted, a man of simple appearance, mature age, dark skin, small stature, 3 cubits high, very short, under 5 feet. Hunchbacked, with a long face, long nose, and meeting eyebrows, so that they who see him might be affrighted, with scanty hair. That's probably what he was. He probably looked like a raving nutbag. He certainly acted like one. So his physical appearance probably reflected that as well. With scanty hair, with a parting in the middle of his head, after the manner of the Nazarites, and with an undeveloped beard. Imagine that. Sounds like the great Jesus, the follower of the Nazarites. Which is why he was called Jesus of Nazareth. Probably a mistranslation, guys, because in the time of Christ, it appears there wasn't a place called Nazareth. That came along later. It was probably a reference to the fact that he was a Nazarite. Oh my God, man. This is probably a reference to the warrant for his arrest. Anyway. But, was Christ truly fearful looking and short? According to the apocryphal book, The Acts of John, John said of Christ, or whoever wrote this book, quote, I was afraid and cried out, and he, Christ, turning about, appeared as a man of small stature and caught hold on my beard and pulled it and said to me, John, be not fearless, but believing and not curious. So, according to this, yeah, he was short. He was a fearsome individual. That would only make sense. All these insurrectionists were fearful looking. A lot of them had scars from, previous battles, previous uprisings that they had survived. So he probably wasn't a pleasant thing to look at. In Luke 19:3, we read about a man named Zacchaeus who tried to see Jesus through a crowd. Here's what it says. And he sought to see Jesus, who he was, and he could not for or on account of the crowd because he was low of stature. So now we see in one of the canonical gospels that Jesus was, in fact, short. So this warrant made reference to here by Josephus probably is referring to Christ. Very interesting. Anyway, to further show that Christ was indeed planning an uprising, let's take a look at something very interesting that took place at the Last Supper just prior to Christ's capture and trial. Luke 22, verses 36 to 38 says this. He, Jesus, said to them, but now if you have a purse, take it, and also a bag. And if you don't have a sword, sell your cloak and buy one. It is written, and he was numbered with the transgressors. And I tell you that this must be fulfilled in me. Yes, what is written about me is reaching its fulfillment. The disciples said, see, Lord, here are two swords. That's enough, he replied. They came back with two swords. He said, yeah, that should do it. Why did he say that? Why did he tell them to get goddamn swords, ladies and gentlemen? Because he was hoping that a small company was going to come to arrest him, that they would figure, yeah, it's just going to be him and a few followers. They'll be easy to overtake. We don't need that many people. And so if they had just but two swords, he figured that would be it. That's all that would be needed to start a revolution. You only need one small spark. So if the disciples had those two swords, it would probably be enough to overtake the two or three people that were sent. Maybe, the high priest and a couple Roman soldiers. They could easily, overtake them easily. And even if they didn't, maybe the people seeing this would finally rise up. Hey, this is our king, It didn't happen the way they planned. I actually had somebody tell me, are you serious? You really think he thought he was going to start a revolution with two swords? Yes, because he wasn't bargaining on a huge 500-plus Roman, legional segment showing up to arrest him. He had no idea they were going to bring that many people. And you know what? They planned well. they figured that, yeah, the potential is there. He might have a bunch of people hiding, you know, to ambush us. Or maybe the masses will rise up, having seen him walked or marched into Jerusalem on the donkey, you know. They had the Romans convinced, yeah, sure, just like so many other messianic claimants that they had to deal with previously, that had a lot of followers and were a potential problem. They didn't want to take any chances with this guy. But, you know, what do you make of this Bible dupes? Christ telling his disciples to buy two swords. And then notice later the schizophrenic message when Peter raises his sword and cuts the ears off, one of the ears off of one of the attendees of the priests, you know, in the company to arrest Jesus. What does Jesus say? Oh, put away your sword, Peter. He that lives by the sword will die by the sword. Of course he had to say that. He had to make it look like, no, I'm not a rebel rouser. It wasn't our intention to have an uprising. When he's the one who told them to bring the goddamn sword in the first place. If Jesus knew the future, right? Like we're told in so many other stories in the Gospels. His Dada was in constant contact with him, having daily communications. Why did he tell them to bring swords, knowing that this was going to create more trouble for them than what they needed at that time? Why didn't the great Yah say, oh, no, don't bring your swords. It's not going to help your cause. There's going to be too many people. Or instead, why didn't the great Yah, you know, but of course Christian dupes would say, oh, that's because Yahweh didn't want an uprising. He wanted Jesus to go to the cross. Ah, for God's sakes. Your little Jesus myth is nothing but that. It's a myth. It can be proven, and indeed, I've gone over this in great detail in the past, and I'm going to return to this too in another context, but I'm going to return to the idea of Jesus not being God when I talk about how the Trinity doctrine developed in the early centuries. I'll be doing that show coming up in the coming, I don't know, weeks, months, whatever. Oh, what a story that is. Christianity has nothing to be proud of. Your entire history is a fraud. Never mind the Bible itself, the Gospels, the whole frickin' fictitious story. Your entire history is such a pathetic, tragic, frickin' scam of a story. The whopping majority of Christians today insist upon belief in the Trinity and claim that if you don't accept it, you're not a true Christian. And yet that goddamn thing was invented in the fourth century, with the blessings of the great Roman Church that so many Christians claim to be opposed to because of its abuses and false claims and false teaching, yet you're totally in league with its fourth century created triune deity. you gotta love it. What a goddamn frickin' mess. The whole frickin' thing, guys, through and through, like a Snickers bar, no matter where you slice it, it comes up frickin' peanuts. So your Jesus wasn't a hero. He was an insurrectionist. He wasn't a great godly man. He was a frickin' monster. He wasn't God in human flesh. He was a goddamn human being. That's all he was. A very twisted human being at that. Anyway. Some would argue that Christ rebuked Peter. You know, again, for cutting off the high priest. Again, this was just window dressing. It was face-saving is what it was. Why did he tell them to bring the swords in the first place? If Dadi was in constant contact with him, why didn't Dada tell him, you know, Jesus, that was a bad idea, the whole sword thing. Tell the disciples to cancel that plan and not bring the swords because, you know, it's just going to incite more anger against you and convince them all the more that you're planning an insurrection. Why in the hell? If Jesus only turned around to tell him he that lives by the sword will die by it, when then what the frig did he tell them to bring the swords for in the first place, pray tell, my dearly duped Christian friends out there? Why did he tell them to do it? Hello? Obviously, he was planning an insurrection and it didn't play out the way he had hoped. That's why. That's the only explanation for it. Did he tell them to bring swords so he could turn around and tell Peter, he that kills by the sword is going to die by it? Get the frig out of here. Anyway. Obviously, the part of the story of, you know, of Jesus rebuking Peter is a later corruption of the text that was added in, God damn it, to make him look, oh yeah, see, he's a Prince of Peace, but they forgot to remove the part where he told him to get the sword in the first place. Or else, again, he was simply thereby telling his disciples that the insurrection was being called off, at least for the time being, if he did in fact make that statement and it wasn't a later addition. And, you know, we'll have more to say on that later. Anyway, some would argue, once again, that two swords was by no means enough to start an insurrection. But no, it was. That's all you need, guys, is one spark. That's all it was hoped for. Jesus didn't think that two swords was going to necessarily apprehend them. It was just hoped that it would set off an uprising. Look what started World War I, guys. One bullet, assassination of Francis Ferdinand, and the whole thing exploded like a freaking powder keg, didn't it? Exactly according to plan. It hasn't always worked that way, though. It didn't work here. It was hoped it would, but it didn't. Anyway, Christ, again, didn't bargain on such a large group of Roman soldiers showing up. Anyway, let's now look at what happened at the time of the arrest by quoting from all four gospel accounts. In Matthew 26, verses 47 and 50, we read, "And while he was still speaking, behold, Judas, one of the 12, came up, accompanied by a great multitude with swords and clubs," a great multitude, "from the chief priests and elders of the people. And Jesus said to him, 'Friend, do what you have come for.' Then they came and laid hands on Jesus and seized him." Friend? He calls him friend. That's interesting. Was Judas doing what Jesus wanted? Was this betrayal intended to spark an insurrection that somehow failed? Anyway, friend, he calls them. That's bizarre. By the way, the other Gospels were told that Judas betrayed Jesus with a kiss. In the book of John, you don't find that at all. No reference to that at all. Anyway, Mark 14:43 says, "And immediately, while he was still speaking, Judas, one of the 12, came accompanied by a multitude with swords and clubs from the chief priests and the scribes and the elders." Luke's version reads this this way, chapter 22, verse 47. "While he was still speaking, behold, a multitude came, and the one called Judas, one of the 12, was preceding them, and he approached Jesus to kiss him." So far, there is a basic agreement between these three gospel accounts in that there was a large multitude of armed individuals from the chief priests. But who was this large multitude, or what was this large multitude comprised of? Who were these people? Being from the priests doesn't have to imply religious supporters of the scribes and Pharisees. In fact, it need only mean that the priests solicited the services of this group. But what group was it? John's gospel account of this incident clears up the mystery for us. John 18:12 says, "So the Roman cohort and the commander and the officers of the Jews arrested Jesus and bound him." The Roman cohort. The Roman legion was, on average, about 6,000 soldiers, and a cohort was 1/10 of a legion. So we are looking here at an army of between 500 and 600 men. Now, why would the Romans have sent that many men armed with clubs and swords just to apprehend an alleged pacifist religious leader? Isn't it obvious that an insurrection was expected from this zealot and that it failed because too many Romans showed up? At his trial, the chief priest told Pilate, he stirs up the people all over Judea by his teaching. He started in Galilee and has come all the way here. Unbelievable, guys. They knew that he was stirring up the people. Stirring up to what? Stirring them up to an insurrection because he came from Galilee. The fact that they mentioned Galilee was to tip them off. Oh, yeah, he's an insurrectionist, all right. That's where they all come from. That's where all of these uprisings stemmed from. Both the Pharisees and the Sadducees were split in their loyalties to Rome. There were many in both camps who favored Caesar as their king. But in any case, by the chief priest shouting out in John 19:15, we have no king but Caesar, were they not making it clear that they didn't want to be associated with this zealot and his failed insurrection, that they were rejecting him as king because they knew what he was leading them to? Of course, guys. They were the bad guys in this? The hell they were. Jesus was the goddamn bad guy. If Jesus had simply committed sacrilege by claiming to be the Son of God, the Jews, once again, would have stoned him the same as they would have stoned the woman who committed adultery. No, he was guilty of a much worse crime. He was an insurrectionist. That's why they turned him over to Rome, guys. Yeah, you know, and they were probably afraid that if they did execute him in that fashion, stoned him, that many of his followers would probably rise up. They knew what fanatic nutballs they were. So have the Romans do it. And let's face it, that only made sense anyway, because at the time, that was a far worse crime. They didn't want any part of that. They knew that the Romans had them outnumbered and overpowered. They knew it was absolute foolishness to incite them to anger and to retaliate. Look what happened. Some might claim that all this theory doesn't hold because Pilate had washed his hands of the matter. But this part of the narrative, again, was probably added later, guys. It turns out that Pilate was, himself, very bloodthirsty. He didn't tolerate insubordination in any way, shape, or fashion. You didn't have to even do anything to incite an uprising. Have to have a sword in hand and have a big following threatening to. No, just the talk of it was enough, and he'd have you executed. He was so over the top with his lack of tolerance for insubordination that he was called to Rome on several occasions to give account for his bad behavior. His reputation was widely known for having, zero tolerance, for killing people by just looking at him funny. So, the story in the Gospels, like so many other, false claims, my God, there's so many inaccuracies in these goddamn books. One gospel says Jesus was born at the time of Herod the Great, and then later we're told that he was born at the time of Quirinius. Quirinius didn't come into office until 10 years after frickin' Herod's death, for Christ's sakes. So, look at the contradictions here. You can't harmonize these damn things. It's impossible. I did entire shows on this in the past. I don't need to elaborate on that. But the gospel accounts are so outrageously contradictory. They contradict their own selves. They contradict historical facts. It's all gibberish, fantasy, fairy tales. Nevertheless, though, just as we're doing now, there's enough information in there that you can make sense of this story. But the sense that comes out of it is not the fairy tale that Bible dupes want you to believe. The sense that comes out of it reveals that we're dealing here with yet another first century fanatical nutbag religious fricktard who used religion as a cloak to disguise his political aims. That's all it is, ladies and gentlemen. That's all it ever was. And here we are over 2,000 years later. You still have religious fanatical nuttards following this freak job and still blasting people with thunderbolts of heresy, you pagan, for not accepting this insurrectionist's nutbag religious ramblings. Unbelievable. God damn unfreaking believable. Holy horse crap. What particularly astonishes me is that you have so many seemingly Jew-wise people falling for this. And some of them are sincere. You know, I have a great respect for people like Tex Mars and Brother Nathaniel. Although you can bet Brother Nathaniel would never come on my show. I've had many people ask me that. No way. I won't even bother wasting my time. He won't come on this show. All he has to do is just randomly listen to one of my Bible bashing rants. He'll never do it. Even though I like the guy, I like what he does. You know, he's done a lot of good work, has some great articles, great video presentations. You know, I wouldn't have a problem interviewing him, but he would have a problem with me. Isn't that pathetic? Because I don't accept his fire-breathing dragon, frickin' Jewish tribal deity. He would have a problem with me. Why? Why would that bother him? Even though I despise, you know, his religion, not him, but his religion, detest it, defy it, deny it, you know, abominate it. I don't despise him. That's how religiotards work, guys. If you speak out against the religion, you're evil. It doesn't matter that, you know, you're fighting the same enemy. And no, they don't see that. They don't see that. You have spoken against my great God. He's going to fry your ass one day. It's so disgusting. It's freaking pathetic. In his estimation, I'm of the devil. Your God is the devil. God damn it. But anyway. Isn't it disgusting, guys? 2,000 plus years later, here we are. People are still falling for this horse crap. Fanatically so. Are we ever going to free ourselves from the clutches of this BS? Are we ever going to finally see it for what it is and realize it hasn't done any good for us? No, it hasn't. Nothing. All that's come out of this is misery, suffering, bloodshed, war, you know, divisions, hateful condemnation. Break the whole mess. Short break, guys.
Of World War II are rarely presented, as history is written by the victors, so all we really hear about is the mass murder of a thoroughly debunked 6 million. We You're never told about the suffering of the German people during that so-called good war. And if it is brought up, we are told that those Nazis deserved it. Firebombed, raped, tortured, slaughtered in the most sickening ways imaginable. But the world has been left in the dark about these atrocities. Until now. Hellstorm is setting the record straight. Watch the documentary that has shaken the world. Available for free at hellstormdocumentary.com.
Guys, welcome back. Or, you know, final segment here. Again, Bible dupes would argue that, oh no, Pilate didn't view Christ as an insurrectionist, or else he wouldn't have washed his hands of the matter, remember? But again, guys, this part of the narrative was probably added later. This is so out of character for Pilate. I'll get into that in more detail in a minute. But let's look at some other inconsistencies in the story, the gospel narrative. Why should we believe that he washed his hands? Look at the story, for example, of Pilate's wife, who was allegedly given a dream, supposedly by God, not to condemn Christ, when it was allegedly God's will that Christ die on the cross in the first place. Why was she given that dream? And furthermore, since Christ died anyway, we're told, what purpose could that alleged dream have possibly served? Don't touch that innocent man. Don't crucify him. He's innocent. Why would the great Yah give this woman a dream like that once again when, A, the great Yah wanted him to go to his death, right? So he could die for the sins of the world and save the world, supposedly. But since it didn't accomplish anything anyway, he still died. My God, it doesn't make, none of this makes any sense. Anyway, it's highly doubtful that Pilate would have washed his hands, as I said, and claimed Christ innocent when, after asking him, "Are you the King of the Jews?" Jesus answered, "I am." Pilate would have seen that Jesus was indeed guilty of sedition. It turns out, as I said, that Pilate was a tyrant and would stop at nothing to severely punish anyone and everyone that posed any type of threat at all to Rome's authority, or to his authority for that matter. He would never have been lenient to Christ or any other Jew who was deemed a rabble-rouser. Josephus reported several occurrences where Pilate flagrantly incited himself insurrections in order to ruthlessly purge them with his soldiers. In other words, he was completely intolerant of sedition. He would try to arouse rebel rousers just to bring them out of the closet and then have them executed. As I said, he was eventually recalled to Vitellius, then the legate of Syria, after a particularly violent attack on the Samaritans in 36 AD, and was later ordered to appear in Rome to face accusations of merciless slaughter. There's no way, having asked Jesus, "Are you the king of the Jews?" and he answered, "I am." There's no way, guys, he would have washed his hands. They make Pilate out to be this wishy-washy, mamby-pamby. Get the frig out. The Gospels are so full of crap, guys. Again, it's like the book of Daniel in the Old Testament. I love this one. If you read the book of Daniel, this is a whopper of a blunder. If you read the book of Daniel, you would get the impression that King Nebuchadnezzar died and that his son, supposedly his son, King Belshazzar, assumed the throne immediately upon Nebuchadnezzar's death. This is how we know that the author of Daniel, or at least this section of the book of Daniel, which has Nebuchadnezzar dying and Belshazzar taking the throne, inheriting it from his father, this is where you know that the author of this book, or at least that part of the book, added this in centuries later and had no clue about who Belshazzar actually was. Belshazzar was not Nebuchadnezzar's son. Understand that in ancient times, if your great-great-great-great-grandfather was a well-known person, you would be called the son of Belshazzamoth, or whatever the frig his name was. You know, you would be called his son, even though several generations separated you from your great-great-great-great-great-grandfather. You wouldn't be called his great-great-great-great-great-grandson. They would call you his son, even though, once again, many generations. So that's what was going on here. Belshazzar was only the son of Nebuchadnezzar in the sense that he was his great-great-great-great-frickin'. There was about six generations that separated King Nebuchadnezzar from King Belshazzar. Belshazzar never met, never personally knew Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar had long since been buried by centuries by the time Belshazzar came along. In fact, Belshazzar was a vassal that had served under the suzerain lord, of Persia. Babylon had long since fallen by the time Belshazzar came into power. Yet again, the book of Daniel has them immediately succeeding one after the other and has Belshazzar as Nebuchadnezzar's son. Just another example of outrageous historical inaccuracies in this book of frickin' nonsense. And yet Bible dudes claim it's the infallible word of God. Again, Pilate would not have taken lightly the claim of Jesus that he was the king of the Jews, guys. That would have been the end. He would not have, quote, washed his hands. Get the frig out of here. Well, let us now move on to another interesting account from the story of Christ's trial, as recorded in Mark 15:7, which says, a man called Barabbas was in prison with the insurrectionists who had committed murder in the uprising. Interestingly, Barabbas means son of the father. One ancient manuscript refers to this individual as Jesus Barabbas. Were these two people one and the same? Jesus Barabbas. Very interesting, guys. Notice what it says here of him. He was in prison with the insurrectionists who had committed murder in the uprising. Was there an uprising? And the gospel accounts conveniently left that out. An uprising that failed. And so now the people, in fear for their lives, sided with the scribes and Pharisees, pretended they were never for this guy. Yeah, kill him, kill him. So they themselves wouldn't be killed, arrested and killed for, you know, participating. Guys, there were cases where the Romans came in to crush these uprisings. They would slaughter hundreds of people, either with a sword, or they would simply arrest them and crucify them by the hundreds and leave the crosses up for days all over Jerusalem as a sign that you'll face this same fate if you don't knock it off. Oh, what a great day it must have been to have lived back then. They didn't put up with their crap. They'd put them on stakes, impale them. You gotta love it, man. Oh, that we would have leaders today with such testicular fortitude. Anyway, so, you know, if that be the case, if this Jesus Barabbas was in fact Jesus, and there was a failed uprising, and he went to prison with the other insurrectionists, then this whole gospel narrative here of his trial obviously is scandalously fraudulent, isn't it? Of course, they made this up, guys. They made him into a hero. They made him into a martyr, that he was murdered, and that later he rose again and triumphed. They made him into a god. That's all they did. And then as time went on, of course, Paul slash Josephus, whatever, mutated the religion even more to get Gentiles, you know, to fall for it so they could recruit them and use them for whatever purpose down the line. Oh, and have they ever used them? They still continue to do so, don't they? Mindless, gullible saps. Anyway, if Jesus and Jesus Barabbas were one and the same, then perhaps he went on, after being freed from prison, to incite more insurrections and never went to the cross. That whole part of the story in this scenario would be fraudulent as well. There's plenty of evidence that he didn't die on that cross, guys. We'll be looking at that, well, probably not till tomorrow, but... Anyway, let's see here. I got off on a tangent. Now I got to find where I left off. Sorry about that. Oh, here we go. Josephus may have been making reference to one of these Barabbas Jesus insurrections in the following passage. He wrote, "About this time, someone came out of Egypt to Jerusalem, claiming to be a prophet. He advised the crowd to go along with him to the Mount of Olives." Didn't Jesus often go to the Mount of Olives? "As it was called, which lay over against the city." Notice it said he came from Egypt. But guess what, guys? Jesus is said to have come from Egypt, too. "Out of thee," we're told, you know, the great Yah says, "I have called thee from Egypt." They refer to that, supposedly, as when, you know, he fled to Egypt from the alleged order of Herod to kill all babies 2 years and under, remember? So, you know, Mary and Joseph took him into Egypt. But it doesn't matter, guys. He spent, according to that story, at least 2 years in Egypt. So he did, quote, come from Egypt. So is this account here from Josephus making reference to Jesus from Egypt? Let me read it again from the start. "About this time, someone came out of Egypt to Jerusalem claiming to be a prophet." Did Jesus disappear to Egypt during those unaccounted 4 years, you know, from the time he was 12 until about 27, 30, whatever? He disappeared all those years, right? At least 15 years. There's no account in the Gospels where the hell he went. Did he go back to Egypt, having spent, you know, his early childhood years there? Did he return to get some more instruction? There was a lot of Jewish settlements in Egypt, guys. The Qumran sect had a branch there. Is that where he went and got some of his training? We'll look at that on a future show, the evidence of that. Oh, it's pretty convincing. Anyway, Josephus continued. He added, this insurrectionist here from Egypt, he added that he would show them from hence how the walls of Jerusalem would fall down at his command. And he promised them that he would procure them an entrance into the city through those collapsed walls. Didn't Jesus talk about how the Romans were going to march in? Not one stone would be left upon another. Everything would be cast down. Everything would be destroyed. This sounds like Jesus, doesn't it? Now, when Felix was informed of these things, he ordered his soldiers to take their weapons and came against them with a great number of horsemen and footmen from Jerusalem. Isn't this the group of 600 soldiers that went into the Garden of Gethsemane to arrest Jesus? Is that what Josephus is talking about here? God damn it, guys. Josephus then went on to say that the Egyptian escaped and was not heard from again. Unbelievable. So if this is in fact a reference to Christ, yeah, he escaped. He wasn't crucified. They made this story up to make him into a martyr, guys. He continued to live on and incite other uprisings and probably took part in the 66 uprising that led to the ultimate destruction of Jerusalem. This account bears some striking similarities to an apocryphal version of Christ's crucifixion, in which Christ survived and a substitute, Simon of Cyrene, was crucified in his place. Thus Christ, or Jesus Barabbas, may indeed have gone on to stir up insurrections after his initial one had failed in Gethsemane. You know, the Garden of Gethsemane. Along this line, the Apocalypse of Peter states, quote, but he into whose hands and feet they are driving the nails is his fleshly part, which is the substitute. Here's an interesting related passage from the Apocryphal Acts of John, which quotes from Jesus, who said to his disciples, quote, you hear that I suffered, yet I suffered not, that I suffered not, yet I did suffer, that I was pierced, yet was I not wounded, hanged, and I was not hanged, that blood flowed from me, yet it did not flow, and in a word, those things that they say of me, I did not endure, and the things that they do not say, those I suffered. In other words, according to this apocryphal book, which can't be true because it wasn't canonized by the Holy Roman Catholic Church. Guys, look what it's saying here. That everything said about Jesus isn't true. The very opposite is true. Well, we've been seeing that about a lot of things, haven't we? So I would say that this is a pretty accurate account here, wouldn't you? In such a case, it would make sense that, according to Luke 23:49, most people witnessing Christ's alleged crucifixion stood afar off, we're told. That way there, no one could recognize whether it was really Christ on the cross or not. Thus, the claim in the apocryphal books that he was substituted with Simon of Cyrene is probably true. The people stood afar off. They weren't allowed to come near the cross. Only a few, like Mary at the foot of the cross, were close enough to see who it really was. Maybe she was in on the little gag. But the whopping majority of onlookers could not see him clearly.
And they didn't have binoculars back then.
Guys, it probably wasn't him, God damn it. Unbelievable. You know, later he probably shaved his beard off and cut his hair so that people wouldn't recognize him. Probably dyed his hair too. Who knows? Wow. How do you like that, Jesus freaks? Great Jesus not only isn't God. You can prove that from the pages of your own goddamn book that you don't even understand. Don't even pay attention to. not only wasn't God, but he wasn't a hero. He was a rabble-rousing insurrectionist bastard. Here's another scenario also suggested by Josephus. He had written about another Jesus, the son of Zacchaeus, who might actually have been the same guy as Jesus Barnabas. Who knows? Or Jesus Barabbas, whatever. This Jesus Zacchaeus, who was said to be the leader of a sedition mob of mariners in the vicinity of Tiberias. Mariners, i.e. fishermen guys, seafarers, fishermen. Jesus was, in fact, a leader of fishermen, wasn't he? Anyway, if this is, in fact, again, a reference to Jesus, we have further confirmation here that he was a seditious, subversive leader, because that's what Josephus says of him. As far as the name Zacchaeus goes, this may have been the family surname of Joseph, which Jesus inherited as, his stepdad. Or his adopted father, you know. Josephus, furthermore, said of this individual that he was from Galilee and that he was an innovator beyond all others. That sounds like Jesus too, doesn't it? He was also a high priest and a general, a militant leader. Jesus was a priest. In fact, he was called Rabbi, right? He was a Pharisee. He wore a robe with the same tassels. Remember, I pointed that out. What is it called? The tzitzit. The priestly tassels. The woman reached out, remember, and said, oh, if I could only touch the hem of his garment. The translation of that literally refers to the tzitzit, which was only found on the priestly garments. If I can only reach out and touch his tzitzit, I will be healed. Oh, frickin' please. And then remember that story we read last week from the book of Acts regarding Paul, where his apron was passed around and anybody who touched it was healed. You gotta love that. You Protestant ignoramuses out there, don't condemn Catholics for their use of relics. They were doing it in the New Testament era. Oh, yes. Paul's Masonic apron was said to have had healing powers. What a crockery. Goddamn witchcraft as well. That's all this is. Frickin' what a... it's so disgusting. That I pissed away over 40 years of my life with this horse crap. But it's finally now paying off because all that learning I did, now I can finally put it to good use. Anyway, that's not all. Josephus also makes reference to a Jesus, the son of Ananias. This may possibly be a reference to the same Jesus, son of Zacchaeus, since he was also a rebel and came from the same area and lived at the same time. Furthermore, he was also said to have been a high priest as well as a leader of a rebellious band of mariners. But there's still more, which further connects this individual with the biblical Jesus. He is also referred to as a plebeian, or a common man, and a husbandman, which was a term that the New Testament Jesus used to refer to himself, ladies and gentlemen. This same Jesus was said by Josephus to have lamented over the coming fate of Jerusalem, just like the biblical Jesus did. And because of this, this Jesus was persecuted, just as the biblical Jesus was. Was Josephus making up multiple Jesuses, yet all referring to the same Jesus, just to confuse his readers so that nobody would connect him with having once been a follower of the biblical Jesus, maybe Josephus was. If in fact, as I suggested in the previous few days, that he was the Apostle Paul, or at least assumed the name of Paul, wrote under the name of Paul after Paul's death, then you could say that he was somewhat of a Christian, right? Or you know, pretending to be, using this religion to succor the goy masses. So in that sense, he was a follower of Jesus. So wouldn't it make sense? He didn't want to be connected, though, with this Jesus in any way, shape, or form. So he made up these multiple names that were, in fact, all referring to the same Jesus. They all hold multiple similarities with the biblical Jesus. In fact, notice what Josephus said about the persecution of this Jesus and how he reacted to it in the same fashion as the biblical Jesus reacted to his own persecution. Here's what Josephus wrote. Certain of the most eminent among the populace had great indignation at this dire cry of his and took up the man, Jesus, and gave him a great number of severe stripes, lashes from a whip. We're told Jesus was whipped, right? Yet he did not say anything for himself or anything peculiar to those that chastised him, but still he went on with the same words, supposing, as the case proved to be, that his was a sort of divine fury in the man, that this was a sort of divine fury in the man. They brought him to the Roman proctor, where he was whipped till his bones were laid bare, yet still he did not make any supplication for himself, nor shed any tears. Isn't this what the Gospels say about Jesus? He answered not a word, right? So maybe this Jesus did go so far as to face, a whipping, right? But then later, some time after that, they switched him, and he never went to the cross. Oh, guys, man, this whole story is so full of holes. All right, guys, that's it for today. We'll pick up there tomorrow. Have a great day. Take care.
Are you constantly thinking naughty, hateful thoughts about the Jews? Do you find yourself actually wishing the gas chambers were real? Do you hate the sight of a yarmulke because it reminds you of the parasitic race that has their greedy little hands in just about everything? Well, then we have got something for you. Ask your doctor about Anti-Semitox. Anti-Semitox is a long-acting injectable lobotomy that assures you will never think those anti-Semitic thoughts ever again. May cause suicide, depersonalization, thoughts of ripping off your skin, your dick may fall off, and you may become infertile. I made the switch to Anti-Semitox. Now I don't even care if I'm a goyim slave. Thanks, Jews!
The past is gone.